The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by her statement that, quote, when we're talking about infrastructure, it's not just about the projects we in the government are responsible for, we also have the opportunity to partner with communities, with iwi and local government. That's what the $2.6 billion worth of shovel-ready projects we announced earlier this week were all about, end quote.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes. I also went on to say, quote, things like Home Ground, a project by the Auckland City Mission that will provide 80 apartments with wraparound support and care, or the Poverty Bay Rugby Park grandstand, or right through to the Invercargill inner city development. Collectively, these projects are estimated to create over 20,000 jobs in the next 5 years, end quote. Mr. Speaker, these projects demonstrate our commitment to infrastructure that creates jobs, contributes to our communities, and achieves more than roading projects alone. Mr. Speaker, I'm very proud to be of the Government of Infrastructure.
Order.
Why is the Government not releasing the full list of projects and starting work when it has been reported that 45% of engineering consulting firms are now considering cutting staff?
Mr. Speaker, first of all, it would be wrong to assume that the sum of the government's infrastructure announcements are the COVID response and recovery infrastructure projects. In fact, the New Zealand upgrade announced in February is $12 billion worth of infrastructure, which, Mr. Speaker, in education alone, $249 million worth of projects have already been approved for 2,400 projects. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, when the COVID pandemic hit, we moved straight away to generate jobs through infrastructure. On the 1st of April, we created the Infrastructure Reference Group. On the 17th of May, we received over 1,900 potential projects. That was then provided to ministers. We worked through a shortlist of 800. On the 29th of June, very quickly, they were signed off, and on the 1st of July, they started to be rolled out. Mr. Speaker, we've already had hundreds of millions of dollars worth announced. Some we continue with due diligence, but we are moving as swiftly as we can.
Does the Prime Minister acknowledge that there are 200,000 construction workers in receipt of the wage subsidy, and there is a crying need to get shovel-ready projects underway faster than she says her government is capable of?
Speaker, one of the issues with making sure we have shovel-ready projects is that we had an infrastructure deficit left by the last government. In health alone, we had projects that we have had to wind up as a government because DHBs did nothing to prepare for their capital works because they were provided with no support from the last government to do it. That is why we've had a deficit of shovel-ready projects. Mr. Speaker, though, to come directly to the answer to the member's question, again, it is wrong to say that solely we are reliant on the COVID response projects to provide a pipeline of work. In fact, we are the government that established the Infrastructure Commission to determine that pipeline as well. We already have $750 million worth of projects announced. We are moving quickly, but we are ensuring due diligence as well.
Can she explain why her government's program has resulted in industry leaders stating, quote, the current situation is incredibly frustrating. We know the workers out there, but unless we know where, what, and most importantly, when projects will start, contractors are left totally in the dark. They will have no choice but to put workers off or face the risk of companies going under, end quote.
Mr. Speaker, again, as the Government of Infrastructure, this is the investment of this government in infrastructure. And Mr. Speaker, can I point out that this is actually the generous graph? This is the one that includes... This includes the Future Investment Fund, where the last government sold assets in order to put a paltry amount into infrastructure. Mr. Speaker, this government is a government that has acknowledged that we, A, had a deficit, but not only in projects, but in skills. And that is why we have invested over $1 billion to make sure that we overcome that deficit and the legacy of that member's government as well.
Is it true? her government's processes have led to industry leaders stating, quote, the problem now was that no one could see 6 to 12 months ahead, so they were taking risks, even retaining staff, on assumptions that work would appear, or else they have to cut back the hours, end quote.
Mr. Speaker, I've read the full context of that exact article the member quotes from, and I'd like to again point out actually another part of that article. It says we've seen this happen before. In the early 90s, thousands of jobs were shared, creating a capability crisis lasting
a decade. Turn the volume down.
A capability crisis lasting a decade whose ripples remain today. The loss of skill and capacity in engineering and construction meant underinvestment. We are still having to repair from the underinvestment of significant underinvestment of the last government. We are doing that. $1 billion into skills, $12 billion into the New Zealand upgrade, and in the last budget alone, $45 billion in infrastructure and an infrastructure commission to create the pipeline of work that that member's last government did not.
Is she concerned that projects are being rolled out over coming weeks by ministerial visits, as confirmed by Shane Jones, who said when asked, quote, he wouldn't want to break a habit, end quote, when there are so many jobs dependent on those projects being announced, and they could be announced now, not waiting on a ministerial visit?
Mr. Speaker, no. Oh.
Is she concerned... what is her response to Infrastructure NZ Chief Executive Paul Blair, who has said companies are running out of time, quote, it's very stressful, it's increasing costs, and it's completely avoidable. The full list and timing of shovel-ready projects...
I am going to interrupt the member. The quotes that the member is using are getting unreasonably long. We were relatively liberal with the first quote from the Prime Minister, but I think the member does know she's got to summarise.
Can I do it again?
Yes, the member can start
again. Thank you very much. Thank you. What is her response to Infrastructure NZ Chief Executive Paul Blair, who has said companies are running out of time, quote, it's very stressful, it's increasing costs, and it's completely avoidable?
Speaker, again, I would correct the member that it is incorrect to assume that the bulk of infrastructure investment coming from this government is solely the $2.6 billion from the Infrastructure Reference Group. In fact, the vast majority, of course, has been announced and started rolling out prior to now. Finally, though, Mr. Speaker, we are moving simultaneously. We had over 1,900 projects that we have whittled down as quickly as possible. We are simultaneously working through the final details and contract negotiations whilst announcing them as quickly as we can. It would be wrong for us to announce projects without having done due diligence. The member would be the first to point that out if that was the case.
Then why are 200,000 construction workers on wage subsidies, which are due to expire very soon?
Mr. Speaker, I think you'll find that in the GFC we saw a downturn as well. We are not going to let that happen on our watch. We are working as quickly as we can to make sure that we do not have an environment where, right when we need these projects, that we see people backing away. But, Mr. Speaker, the member is oversimplifying. Many developers, for instance, are experiencing tighter criteria and loaning requirements from their banks. There are a range of factors at play. We are trying to counteract that with our investments.
When will the Prime Minister release the full list of shovel-ready projects to give certainty to the construction workers relying on her government?
Again, for the $2.6 billion, which sits within the over $40 billion or more announced from the Budget 2020, $750 million has already been announced, and we are moving as quickly as we can to finalise any contractual issues and notify successful applicants as quickly as we can.
Question number two, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. Is he confident that the government's COVID-19 related spending is fully justified in providing industry sectors with the certainty they require?
Mr. Speaker,
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, I am confident that the spending is justified given the 1-in-100-year shock to the global and New Zealand economies. The spending has given us the ability to go hard and early against COVID-19, to keep New Zealanders safe, allow our economy to open up sooner, and to support the economic recovery by protecting jobs and investing to create new jobs. I'm also confident that we are providing certainty to industry by ensuring as funding is available for the projects that we are announcing.
So why has his government not announced details of the so-called shovel-ready projects now to give civil contractors as much certainty as possible?
Mr. Speaker, I believe the Prime Minister covered this in some depth in the answer to the previous question. One of the issues, for example, is the issue around due diligence, and to reiterate a point that the Prime Minister has made, I'm sure if we announced projects that hadn't been through that, the Member would be the first to criticise us for that.
Supplementary. So is he saying categorically that each project is being announced immediately after due diligence has been completed by ministers?
Speaker, that is one of the factors that determines when it's announced.
Why is the government, quote, trickling out, end of quote, spending announcements? That's a phrase used by civil contractor industry leaders over the next few weeks in the lead up to an election.
Speaker, again, we have covered this ground. We're making sure the contracts are fully finalised. We're making sure due diligence has been done. I reject the pejorative statement that goes with that, but also endorse what the Prime Minister has said. Along with the infrastructure reference group projects, we have the $12 billion New Zealand upgrade program. We have the massive record investment in health and education infrastructure, all of which is being rolled out as we speak.
Well, what's more important, ministerial announcements in high vis during an election campaign or providing certainty about jobs as soon as possible?
Mr. Speaker, what's important is actually funding the projects that we promise, making sure that the money's there, not just relying on press releases and ghost roads.
Regarding press releases and ghost roads, there was a big press release about light rail in Auckland. How's that coming along?
Mr. Speaker, again, we covered this ground yesterday with the Prime Minister, so I don't think we need to go over that. I did, however, see a press release that said that the first element of a $31 billion infrastructure plan was a four-lane highway with two tunnels, which turned out not to have any funding or any costings at all.
Right, Honourable Winston Peters.
The Minister of Finance, how are the fiscals, the potentials and the legal work going behind the transmission gully stoppage?
Well, regrettably, the public-private partnership signed up to by the previous government is not progressing at a way that this government would be comfortable for. And I think members on the other side may need to take a look in the mirror when it comes to whether or not projects are properly designed and properly funded.
Supplementary, does he think that having the vision to connect 2.5 million New Zealanders who live between Whangarei, Tauranga and Hamilton is not a good idea?
Mr. Speaker, if all the opposition over there have got is a vision, they're going to be over there for a very long time.
Does he think it's appropriate to use scarce scientific funds to send friends of the Deputy Prime Minister to Antarctica?
Order, that's not related to the question. The member knows it and will lose a supplementary as a result.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, Chris Bishop.
Just want to test you on that ruling,
well,
Mr. Speaker.
Well, better not. Order. The primary question was absolutely specific and it did not relate to Antarctica funding. Question number three, Tamati Coffey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, what recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy in the context of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
Mr. Speaker, on Friday, the Treasury released the latest New Zealand Activity Index for June. This showed economic activity continued to bounce back in June to just 0.9% below the same month last year after falls of 18% and 6% in April and May. The continued recovery in June was led by growth in electronic card spending, heavy traffic movements and manufacturing activity, all of which were up on June 2019 levels. While the index was dragged down a little by an increase in the number of people on income support, other indicators such as light traffic movements, business confidence and new job ads posted online also saw a continuing uptick. Mr Speaker, while the New Zealand Activity Index does not show the full economic picture, these are encouraging signs that the economy has bounced back after a difficult past few months.
Supplementary. What reports has he seen on the resilience of New Zealand's economy in the context of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
Yesterday, the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research released a report on the role that land-based industries, such as livestock, forestry and horticulture, have played in New Zealand's economic performance under the COVID-19 pandemic. The report said that whatever COVID-19 has done to other parts of world trade, it has reinforced the underlying strength and importance of New Zealand's land-based industries. NZIER pointed to growth in demand from China and other Asian nations, combined with our flexible and adaptable supply chains and strong and effective institutions as the key reasons for New Zealand's strong trading results through the pandemic so far, with dairy, meat and horticulture sectors up by nearly $1 billion year-to-date compared with this time last year.
For the supplementary, what did the NZIER report say about the outlook for New Zealand's land-based industries?
Mr Speaker, NZIER said that the general picture for exports is one of cautious optimism based on the continued demand for New Zealand farm products despite COVID-19. However, the report did also point to the continued persistence of COVID-19 around the world, and particularly in the UK and US as a key concern, and one that has been highlighted in many other commentaries, including the IMF and the World Bank. Mr Speaker, the government is keenly aware of the importance of trade to economic recovery and of the economic risks from worsening outbreaks and associated restrictions in key export markets. That's why we are working alongside and investing in the future of our exporters, including through the Industry Transformation Plan for the agri-tech sector, announced yesterday by Ministers Twyford and O'Connor. The government is investing $11.4 million in this plan to lift the productivity of the sector, commercialise new products and establish, for example, a horticulture Cultural Robotics Academy.
Question number four, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, what percentage of New Zealanders are using the government's New Zealand COVID Tracer app on a daily basis, and what are its measures of effectiveness?
Mr. Speaker, 617,200 users have registered for the COVID Tracer app. Official statistics record the number of scans per day, not the number of active users per day. Around 12,000 scans are being made each day on average. It's important to remember that the app is just one of the tools available to us. The work of the public health units and the National Close Contact Service remain the mainstays of our contact tracing system. The measure of the app's effectiveness will be how quickly it can be used to support contact tracing in the event that we have cases of COVID-19 in the community that need to be traced.
Supplementary. What are the recent trends in uptake and use of the government's New Zealand COVID Tracer app?
Mr Speaker, there's been a flurry of activity over the last week or so. We've seen a significant number of additional posters printed, around 350 additional posters being printed per day, which is a good sign. There have been in the tens of thousands, I think 20 or 30,000 additional users signing up to register for the app over the last week and a bit. We still have a long, long way to go to get everybody using it, but, you know, we'll keep pushing it.
Supplementary. What are the reasons for more New Zealanders not using the COVID Tracer app, and how will he address this?
Mr Speaker, of course, one of the big issues is that New Zealanders don't, by and large, feel an immediate sense of threat from COVID-19. And that, of course, is a sign of our success as a country and the team of 5 million in stamping out COVID-19. But the message from the government is that there is no room for any of us to be complacent here. We all need to do our bit. I'd encourage all members of Parliament to make sure they're using the app. And I also say to any member of the public, if they want to know why things like the app are important, they could sit down one evening and try and record down everybody that they had come into contact with in the last 2 weeks. Anybody who has tried to do that exercise will know it's a lot harder than they might think it is.
Supplementary, given that reply, does the Minister have the app, And does he scan each QR code he comes in contact with, given his recent statements that these numbers are low and we do want to lift our game here?
Mr Speaker, yes and do. In fact, I even scan in and out of Copperfields every day when I'm using it here in the building.
Mentory, how can he have confidence in the effectiveness of the app when nearly half of the 1,558 reviews on the Google download site give it a one star with complaints it's too hard to use?
Mr Speaker, there's no question. There's no question, Mr Speaker, that there's room for improvement in the app.
I'm taking this as a serious question, and I'd like to hear the answer and not have it shouted down. Some of us think this issue is important to New Zealand.
Mr Speaker, there's no question this. The app was developed at speed during an emergency situation, and of course there was room for improvement. The next update of the app, which will be released before the end of this month, will deal with many of the common complaints from users, including that they can't manually enter in contacts where there isn't a QR code, that will be addressed, that they can't retrospectively add information into the app, that will be addressed as well. But even if people aren't scanning QR codes, merely registering for the app helps the Ministry of Health where contact tracing is required. Already, people's contact details from registering for the app have been used on multiple occasions as part of legitimate contact tracing exercises. So even signing up for the app and making sure that your contact details are up to date is actually a significant step that all New Zealanders should be taking.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Can the Minister confirm the recently found information that we're up to 3.5 stars on the Apple app, and does he credit himself with that?
Well, Mr Speaker, of course, popularity is growing on this side of the House on a daily basis.
Supplementary. What role does an effective coronavirus tracing app have in recovering an economy, and could a poorly performing app hinder recovery?
Mr Speaker, one of the things that of course could hinder a recovery is another outbreak of COVID-19. That could of course be caused by a variety of things, including premature reopening of the border, which is being advocated on by some members in this House, not on this side of the House though, Mr Speaker. One of the best, our first line of defence is our border. The second line of defence is our testing and contact tracing regime. And we need everybody to play their part in ensuring that there is an effective contact tracing regime in place, should we need it.
Yeah. Question number five, Andrew Bailey, or is it sub? Question number five, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Small Business. Is he concerned with the ANZ report issued yesterday that, quote, a net 48% of small businesses feel pessimistic about general business conditions in the year ahead, unquote? If not, why not?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr Speaker, what I am concerned about is perhaps the Minister hasn't realised, but we are in the middle of a global pandemic. And what has been proven is that this government's decision to go hard and go early with a health response was also the best thing to do from an economic response. I refer to the MIOB report that was highlighted in the House yesterday by the Honourable Grant Robinson that shows confidence among SMEs is cautiously improving. The more businesses are expecting to see growth in the next 12 months following on from March, when the economy was heading into lockdown. I'd also like to draw the members' notice to the June Zero Small Business Insights report, which also showed that 65% of respondents strongly agreed that New Zealand has an opportunity to rebuild its economy better than before COVID.
Point of order, Mr Speaker, that was a great question, but I actually asked him whether he was concerned, and I haven't actually heard that.
That's right. It was a very long answer, so I think rather than a question, I think the member was referring to. Have a go via supplementary. The member said it was a great question.
Thank you. So I get a supplementary.
May or may not have been.
But, I get a supplementary. Thank you. Yeah. What policies has he implemented, if any, over the past 4 months of this economic crisis to cut regulations for small businesses, given this is the biggest problem identified by small businesses in the ANZ survey?
Mr Speaker, you said my last answer was too long. This one may be even longer if the member really wants me to list what we've done for small businesses since COVID lockdown. We have done a substantial amount. There's a small business cash flow loan scheme, Mr. Speaker, which was rolled out in 2 weeks, no personal guarantees, money out the door. There was a wage subsidy scheme, Mr. Speaker, which in fact we were the first government in the world to get money into the pockets. Again, high trust model, and it kept 1.7 million Kiwis employed. We rolled out a whole lot of tax measures, Mr. Speaker, which made it very easy for small businesses to either comply with their obligations or enter into an arrangement with Inland Revenue to meet their obligations. Mr. Speaker, there are a number of things that this government has done across...
Okay. Between the Minister and Mr. Jones, I think you've answered it.
Point of order. Mr. Speaker, again, I asked about regulations. I'm not sure I heard anything. I heard about tax changes, but they're not regulations. I asked him specifically, what has he done to cut regulations for small businesses?
Member can have a go on the very narrow issue rather than a general rave.
Well, Mr. Speaker, if we make an assumption that cutting regulations means it's easier for businesses to do work, I just have to highlight what we have done with Inland Revenue to make it so much easier for small businesses to comply with their tax obligations. Okay. What we did do...
All right. OK, the members address the question. Question?
What policies has he implemented, if any, over the last 4 months to support small businesses hiring new people, given a third of businesses now expect to shed jobs over the coming year?
Mr. Speaker, Minister Hipkins actually released an apprenticeship and training package worth about $450 million. I think that what we have done in terms of allowing New Zealanders to re-engage with business, to retrain, to get back on the horse, so to speak, has been phenomenal, Mr. Speaker. So for that member to suggest that we have done nothing in terms of allowing small businesses to grow, for workers to become engaged in the economy, to retrain, to train and get back into work, I will note one thing, Mr. Speaker. That member is the fourth small business spokesperson, so I suppose we've got to give him a little bit of latitude.
Wow. In view of the report stating that over half of all small businesses now expect their profits to deteriorate, will the Labor-led government provide meaningful rental support to small businesses? And if not, why not?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think the member would know that's not part of my portfolio responsibility.
Question number six, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Mr. Speaker?
Well, we will go back to Mr. Bailey, but it's really important if the member wants another supplementary that he stands up.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As the Minister for Small Businesses, did he support the increase in the minimum wage effective 1 April 2020 at a very time when most small businesses were not receiving any income?
Mr. Speaker, what we do know is an increase in the minimum wage provides an economic stimulus fiscal stimulus package. Yes, I did support
order,
that because...
Order. Who was that interjecting then? Well, the member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
Mr. Speaker, what I was saying is that an increase in the minimum wage provides a level of fiscal stimulus much needed. What we do know is those on the minimum wage tend to spend a lot of their income, and that is exactly what we need at this point in time.
What hope can you offer small business owners who only see a bleak future, with over half of them pessimistic about business confidence or conditions during the next 12 months?
Speaker, I'll go back to my original answer. We are in the middle of a global pandemic. And in essence, what we are is we have one of the most open economies in the world at this point in time, because what we did is we went early, we went hard, and as a consequence, we can all be where we are at the moment because there has been no community transmission for weeks. What we have done by addressing the health response has allowed our economy to open and therefore for small businesses to do as well as they possibly can.
Question number six, Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development. What recent announcements has she made about supporting employment initiatives in partnership with local government?
The Honourable Carmel
Mr. Cipollone. Speaker, on the 9th of July, along with the Mayor Phil Gough, I announced an extension to our partnership with Auckland Council, the Ngā Puna Pūkenga Skills for Industry Programme. The programme will fund up to 700 placements in Auckland through an investment of $4.34 million to support people into infrastructure and related environmental jobs. Of the 700 placements, 420 will be for youth in receipt of a benefit, those over 25 with 3 or more months on benefit, Māori and Pacifica, and our long-term unemployed, as well as people not in education, employment or training. A further 280 placements are for people made redundant as a direct outcome of COVID-19. This is a key partnership with MSD funding to support pre-work training and job matching, Auckland Council providing opportunities for employment through infrastructure projects, and industry partners taking up new recruits and supporting them to gain new skills and remain in the industry.
What other announcements has she made in partnership with local government?
Mr. Speaker, I also recently announced alongside the Mayor's Task Force for Jobs another extension of a pilot which supports rural councils to implement employment initiatives focused on connecting youth with local small businesses. This extension will see 19 additional rural councils able to access up to $500,000 each to create sustainable employment positions in their regions. The initiative was piloted with 4 councils, Opotiki, Central Hawke's Bay, Rangitike and South Wairarapa, under Alert Level 2, and has been highly successful, with 3 of the 4 councils meeting or exceeding their target of 30 employment outcomes within 5 weeks. Despite challenging circumstances during this COVID recovery period, we continue to see innovative partnerships like these having a positive effect on employment outcomes, local communities and small businesses.
Why are initiatives like these so important?
Mr. Speaker, partnerships are crucial in our COVID recovery phase. Local governments and the Mayor's Task Force for Jobs have important local insights into the specific needs of their communities and are well placed to work alongside government to develop solutions that will work on the ground. Establishing effective partnerships means that we can leverage local government projects, their relationships with both big and small businesses, as well as contribute MSD's expertise of job matching, training and employment support products and services. Mr. Speaker, this government is committed to investing in jobs, people and industries, and these initiatives demonstrate this commitment.
Question number 7, the Honourable Jackie Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Conservation. Does she stand by all her statements and actions in regards to tar management in New Zealand?
The Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, in the context in which they were made or taken. As Minister of Conservation, I stand by the work that the Department of Conservation is doing to implement the Himalayan Tar Control Plan to ensure that the tar population in the iconic Southern Alps is managed in accordance with that statutory plan. And over the last 2.5 years, there has been extensive consultation with hunting groups, and control is now underway to bring tar numbers down to a more sustainable level.
What is the total value to New Zealand's economy of commercial and recreational tar hunting in New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, I have heard estimates of around $14 million, but I would note that the borders are now closed, so the commercial trophy hunting industry does not have a lot of our clients. I would also note that the national parks that she and the Tower Foundation have been worried about, in the last 5 years, there was an average of only 65 tar which were shot as commercial bull tar, which were shot as commercial trophy animals. And so 65 tar in national parks is a niche industry, not a major one.
Does she agree that recreational and commercial tar hunters add economic value to the regions of New Zealand, including the South Island's west coast?
Mr. Speaker, if the member read the Himalayan Tar Control Plan, she would see that it recognises the value of recreational and commercial hunting. However, Those hunters have failed to get tar numbers down to the level that the plan provides for, an upper limit of 10,000 animals. That is why official control is needed. And I'm disappointed that the National Party and that member is turning its back on national parks as a safe haven for our Indigenous plants and wildlife.
Does she consider that expenditure by commercial and recreational tar hunters on accommodation, on travel, hospitality, ammunition and gear supports regional economies?
What I'm concerned about, Mr Speaker, is the threats that are being made to commercial helicopter operators, which are causing those operators to retreat from work they have been doing for decades in controlling tar in the Central Southern Alps. What I'm concerned about is the threats that are being made to the department and to those operators of violence, and they are reported to the police.
Point of order.
Point of order.
Well, thank you, Mr Speaker. The question was quite specific. I was asking whether the Minister considered that expenditure by commercial and recreational tar hunters supported regional economies. I did not hear the Minister address that question at all.
I thought she started with a yes, but I'll just ask her to confirm that.
There is regional economic benefit from tar hunting, but the misinformation that has been put about by the Tar Foundation and others that there is a plan to eradicate tar is simply that misinformation. When these control operations are completed, there will still be thousands of tar across thousands of hectares which recreational and commercial trophy hunters can go out and hunt.
Does she believe that tar control supported by recreation and commercial hunters and the revenue they generate to the tune of $17 million per annum is an important part of our economic recovery post-COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, the member may not have noticed, but the borders are closed, which means that a lot of those international trophy hunters cannot come to New Zealand at present. It is open for recreational hunters to go and hunt tar, and the Department of Conservation has an app on its website which shows where control operations have been undertaken, and there will be thousands of tar available for recreational and commercial hunters to hunt.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Jackie Dean.
Oh, thank you, Mr Speaker. My question again was quite specific. I did ask the Minister...
Yeah, and I'm absolutely convinced that it was not only addressed but answered. Further supplementary? Question number 8, Marama Davidson.
To the Associate Minister of Health, what recent announcements has she made about primary maternity services?
Mr Speaker.
Honourable Julianne Ginter.
Last week I announced the largest ever increase in funding for primary maternity services and the women and babies they support, $242 million. That includes $85 million for additional modules indicating a broader range of services under the Section 88 notice, $60 million to support community maternity initiatives, $35 million for the Maternity Action Plan, $57 million for cost and volume pressures, which includes a 2.818% increase to fees paid to lead maternity carers.
Order, order. Can I just ask the members down there to be a bit quieter? You're coming across through the two mics which are open down there, and it means that people up this end are having trouble hearing it.
$5.4 million for a $2,500 payment to eligible LMC midwives to cover extra COVID-19 related costs. I am proud that independent community midwives under this government will receive better support for the vital role they play in supporting 60,000 newborns and their parents every year.
What specific support will this new funding provide for midwives caring for rural and high needs women and babies?
Previously, all midwives were paid a standard rate, even though midwives supporting women in rural locations and women with complex pregnancies had extra time and costs associated with caring for these women. The new funding will mean that midwives who travel long distances to care for women or who provide extra attention throughout a complex pregnancy, labour and birth will finally be able to be compensated for this additional cost and work.
How will this extra support better meet the needs of wahine Māori, their pēpi and their whānau?
Māori women and
as
babies.
As part of the $35 million maternity action plan, there will be a specific focus on kaupapa Māori approach to maternity care. And this action plan will help reduce avoidable inequities of service by targeting funding and delivering more culturally responsive maternity services. This will be part of the ongoing work undertaken by the Ministry of Health to improve maternity services and working conditions for midwives.
How has the government supported midwives affected by the challenges created by COVID-19?
We all know that during alert levels 4 and 3, many LMC midwives experienced a much higher workload and incurred additional costs due to the need to socially distance. This included taking additional visits to care for expecting mums and newborns during this stressful time. As a result, last month, the government announced that all eligible LMC midwives would receive a one-off $2,500 payment to help cover those additional extra costs incurred during COVID-19. All midwives work extremely hard to care for the women and their babies nationwide, and I'm very proud that they are receiving the support that they deserve.
Question number 9, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections. Does he stand by his statement regarding community sentences, quote, "We expect offenders to complete their hours," unquote?
The Honourable Kelvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, yes, my expectation is that people serving community sentences complete them. Currently, 80% of community sentences are completed, so there is still room for improvement.
Supplementary. How many offenders who had hours remitted from their community service sentence during COVID-19 had failed to report for community service during the 2 months leading up to level 4 lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, that's a very specific question. At various alert levels, community work was unable to take place. 10,745 people were subject to a sentence of community work through the lockdown period, with more than half of these sentences imposed for traffic offences and non-payment of fines. Corrections identified 5,576 people who had demonstrated compliance with these sentences during the month prior to lockdown and remitted on average between 4 to 7 hours a week of community work per offender from 23rd of March to 5th of June.
Supplementary, has the Minister's expectation been met that offenders complete their hours when half of the offenders serving community service sentences had their sentences reduced during COVID-19? And according to the written question 13740, which he provided to me, 2,539 offenders failed to report for their sentence in the 2 months leading up to lockdown.
Well, Mr. Speaker, like all New Zealanders, we had to stop undertaking a range of activities at different alert levels, and community corrections sites were closed to people reporting and staff work remotely. Community work was unable to take place, but offenders on other community sentences continued to be monitored by phone, with home visits carried out where a case had been assessed as high risk or where there were safety concerns. Mr. Speaker, the community corrections did a very tough job making sure that people who had community sentences did as much of it as they could.
So is the Minister telling the House that essentially he has an expectation that those on community service sentences should complete their hours, but his policies have left 2,539 people who didn't turn up in the months leading up to lockdown essentially having more hours off than before?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Did corrections consult with victims of crime prior to the decision being made to reduce court-mandated community sentences?
Mr. Speaker, the offenders at the who were asked to do community hours, most of them, as I said earlier, were there for traffic offences and non-payment of fines. So I'm not quite sure who we're expected to consult with when he's talking about victims.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Minister, during the COVID lockdown, which option did he prefer? Mindlessly, myopically pressing on with enforcement of the law or protecting the public's health during a crisis?
Well, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, Chris
Fisher. I'm just wondering how that supplementary relates at all to the primary question around community sentences.
Well, it relates to about five of the supplementaries. Can you ask the question again? Or have you got the question? Ask it
again. During the COVID lockdown, which option did he prefer, myopically or and mindlessly pursuing with the enforcement of the law or seeking to act in the public health interest?
Well, Mr. Speaker, of course the public health interest, because if we had people doing community hours during that time, they're often picked up in vans, they're carted around the country, that would just been impossible. They would have been in danger of transmitting COVID amongst themselves.
Question number 10, Keir Tapu.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister for Biosecurity. What progress has been made in the eradication of Mycoplasma bovis from New Zealand?
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand's world first effort to eradicate the cattle disease Mycoplasma bovis has made significant progress. 3 years to the day since it was first detected in New Zealand, there have been 250 properties infected by the disease, with all but four now clear of it. As we have, Mr. Speaker, with our response to COVID-19, this government showed leadership, made a tough decision, went hard and went early. This government made the decision to put $880 million into eradication because we back our primary sector. It was estimated, Mr. Speaker, that allowing the disease to spread could have caused $1.3 billion in economic losses to the sector in the first 10 years alone. Mr. Speaker, as we have with COVID, we've been guided by the best science and technical advisory group made up by world experts. Almost 2.5 years into the 10-year effort, I'm pleased by the progress we've made. Our farming community should be really proud of their efforts. Mr. Speaker, this government is certainly very proud of them.
Supplementary, sir. And what changes have been made to the program over the past year?
Mr. Speaker, the eradication effort has not been without substantial challenges. No one in the world has ever attempted this before, so we have been learning as we go. It's not always been perfect, but we have learned and made changes over time. We are serious about learning and improving. Some of the changes we've made include a greater regional focus, more farmer-focused processes, testing is timelier, and research is underway to improve testing further. Mr. Speaker, compensation processes have improved for affected farmers. There is still work to be done, and there will be more infected farms to find, but we're well and truly on track to do what no other country in the world has done to eradicate this disease.
Supplementary, sir. And what support has there been from industry?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased to say that the key to the success of our program are the partners Dairy NZ and Beef and Lamb New Zealand. They were part of the bold decision to attempt to eradicate this disease and have been part of our efforts since the very beginning. The Government Industry Agreement Program has been established, jointly funded and governed and delivered by the Ministry for Primary Industries, Biosecurity New Zealand, Dairy NZ, Beef and Lamb New Zealand. Through farmer levies, industry is funding 32% of the cost of eradication. There's also been support from volunteers of the Rural Support Trust around the country, outstanding organisations, Mr. Speaker, as well as Fonterra, Federated Farmers, Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand, Meat Industry Association and the New Zealand Veterinary Association. Everyone is united in our common goal to free our country of Mycoplasma bovis.
Question number 11, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she have confidence in all her ministers?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
How can she have confidence in Foreign Affairs Minister Winston Peters when RNZ reports that he arranged for his personal friends B. Lin Chu and Su Aan Kwek to go on a taxpayer-funded trip to Antarctica?
Mr. Speaker, I reject the many of the assertions made in that question. First of all, Mr. Speaker, the Minister has pointed out in a statement that I believe that he has made publicly that, alongside the varied interests that a visit Antarctica, including politicians, scientists, musicians, historians, artists. Of course, we also have an interest in redeveloping Scott Base. That was a Cabinet-mandated request of Antarctica New Zealand that they seek extra sponsorship for that redevelopment, and that is the vein in which those individuals visited.
Then can the Prime Minister please outline to the House the open and transparent process her government went through to select philanthropists who might donate to Scott Base before the friends of the Foreign Minister Winston Peters, B. Lin Hu and Sue Ann Quick, were selected to go on that trip at the expense of scientific activity? Order.
Mr. Speaker, to answer the many parts of that question, firstly, I'm advised that no one lost their spot as a result of...
Order.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that no one lost their spot as a result of the two individuals attending. Secondly, of course, it is available publicly known individuals who visit Antarctica. Many members on that side of the House will have visited at some time in their career. Secondly, thirdly, Mr. Speaker, it is part of the public record in a proactive Cabinet release that there was a requirement or an expectation that Antarctic New Zealand would start looking at additional ways to supplement the substantial funding that Cabinet was putting forward for the redevelopment of Scott Base.
Order.
A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, the question was for the Prime Minister to outline the process used
order.
To select them.
She order. Order. Member will resume his seat. The question was addressed. Supplementary, Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
To the Prime Minister, does she know why an OIA response to the National Leader's Office about the visit of B. Lin Hu and Sue Ann Quick to Antarctica had redactions under the Section 6A of the Official Information Act, which is designed to prevent prejudice against New Zealand's security, defence and international relations? And if so, what was specifically discussed with them that caused Section 6A to be used to stop that information being released?
Mr. Speaker, the member will appreciate, obviously I don't have that Official Information Act request in front of me, nor can, so therefore it is impossible for me to speak to a specific redaction. If there are requests on notice or indeed questions on notice, it makes it more plausible for someone to answer a question of that nature.
Mr. Speaker. So has the Prime Minister asked the Foreign Minister what was discussed with these two people who were selected by him to travel to the Antarctic?
Mr. Speaker, obviously, I could not have possibly asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs a question around a redaction which the member has only just asked me about. Secondly, Mr. Speaker, it has been, Mr. Seymour National, giving you two extra supplementaries if you missed that signal. Mr. Speaker, also, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, of course, it has been a long-standing practice that they can support or make suggestions around visits to Antarctica. That is not a new process. And Murray McCulley, I'm sure, would have been involved on many occasions in that regard.
Somebody question?
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, that was an interesting answer from the Prime Minister, but I asked the question if she had asked the Foreign Minister why they were chosen.
Speaker, I've obviously given that answer in this House. The rationale that has been provided, the member asked me about a redaction in an OIA, which I cannot speak to.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Is the Prime Minister aware that over the years, many ministers have sought to expand the international understanding of the importance of Antarctica to us, including asking ambassadors from the EU, asking international shipping registers who imperiled the fishing resource of the Antarctica, that this has all been done over the years, but not one of them has been the source or origin of a race attack?
Yeah.
Well, there is a question. There is a question there.
Mr. Speaker,
order.
I'm aware of a number of different circumstances under which different individuals who have an interest in Antarctica have been part of the visitation program. As I've already said, it is the prerogative of the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade to make recommendations from time to time.
Supplementary.
No, the member knows very well he doesn't have any more supplementaries. Sit down.
Responding to the Prime Minister, who said the Labor Party was happy for me to ask more questions. There you go.
Oh. Member will resume his seat. Question number 12, Brett Hudson.
Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Police. How many incidents were there between the 1st of January and the end of March 2020 involving firearms and gang members or associates?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr. Speaker, the crackdown by police on organised crime, which has been made possible by a significant increase in police numbers and a greater mandate by this government to go hard on gun crime, is having a marked impact. I'm pleased to report that police have detected, disrupted or attended just under 1,000 firearm instances during that period. 88% of these instances were by members of the general public. The incidents range from selling ammunition without a licence to pointing a firearm at a police officer. For example, of those charged with presenting a firearm at a person, 5 were gang members, but 29 were members of the general public. This is why we needed tougher penalties for gun crime, which that party opposed.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. The Minister gave a lot of information there about general members of the public in firearms incidents or offences. The question was specifically related to gang members and associates, and it was on notice and writing.
Well, and I think the member at least addressed the question. Whether he gave all the information that the member wanted, I'm not sure.
Supplementary. Is the Minister concerned about the number being 156 incidents between the 1st of January and the 9th of March at least? Is he concerned with that number of offences committed by gang members or gang associates?
Mr. Speaker, what I can tell that member I am concerned about is that when we came to office, police numbers had dropped in the previous 5 years of the past government. And thanks to New Zealand First, we have delivered over 2,250 new frontline officers into our communities. My concerns around the lack of police have been addressed due to this coalition government.
Order, order. Now the member will address the question that was asked.
Mr. Speaker, whenever there is a firearm incident occurred in this country, no matter by whom, I have concerns. It is why we have significantly increased the penalty for gun crime, and if that member was as concerned as I was, he would have backed the bill.
Supplementary. Has he seen reports of firearms incidents involving gang members or associates resulting in significant physical harm or death to others?
Mr. Speaker, I have seen reports and concerns of firearms crimes being committed, but as I mentioned, 88% of firearms crimes committed in this country were actually by members of the general public, not by gang members. I think that member needs to widen his scope if he is really concerned about fighting firearms offences.
Supplementary. Why then did he not support my Firearms Prohibition Orders members' bill to take guns out of the hands of gang members that present the greatest risk to public safety, along with the majority of Parliament this morning?
Mr. Speaker, I think I made it clear in my primary answer, 88% of gun crime was not committed by gang members. That member's private member's bill dealt specifically with gangs. The regime we are looking at deals with every single person who poses a threat to our communities. It's not just gangs, Mr. Speaker. The other thing I would say is two attorneys general and his previous Prime Minister, Bill English, said that his bill was absolute rubbish.
That concludes oral questions.